Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Rebecca Henderson. She's the MacArthur University professor at Harvard University and author of Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire. You can learn more at reimaginingcapitalism.org. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. In 2007, I interviewed Robert Reich on his book Supercapitalism. A bit of my intro to that conversation. The last three decades have seen the emergence, so this was in 2007, 13 years ago. The last three decades have seen the emergence of a supercharged capitalism fueled by open markets and cutthroat competitiveness. Supercapitalism is overwhelming government with lobbyists and money, while citizens are dazzled by the promise of previously unimaginable riches and consumer choices. The big question Reich tackles in his new book is, can democracy survive in this environment? Now, let me say that that was 2007. The crash was 2008 and 9, and here we are, in 2020. In that book, Reich wrote of America's golden age from the end of World War II through the early 70s. Though these were not the best of times for people of color, women, or the environment, to name a few exceptions, employment was solid and reliable. Wealth was shared. The U.S. was leader of the world in many categories. And at the core of it all was the greatest middle class the world had ever seen. Though that may be a time that MAGA folk look back on fondly, taxes were high, really high at times, and unions were strong. Through the ongoing tussle between industry, labor, and government came success and growth. And rooted in 1960s idealism, we were out to share the prosperity even more. Richard Nixon signed into law both the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. But some in economics and business were not happy with the direction things were taking. And two things happened in 1970 that set us on a course that today's guest is hoping can change. Milton Friedman, in a New York Times op-ed, made his admonition that the sole purpose of corporate behavior was to enhance shareholder value. And attorney and soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote the Powell Memo, advocating that business redefine its relationship to politics and government. Don't let anybody tell you that ideas don't matter. Both of these were just ideas, but they were both adopted with a vengeance, ultimately laying waste to shared prosperity. While much in our culture has come to embody 60s visions, in our culture, I believe the two 60s values that have fared the worst are caring for the planet and economic justice. Why? Follow the money. It is in the narrow and short-term financial interest of wealthy and powerful individuals, corporations, and industries to stall and prevent change in those areas. In addition, despite all the progress in social and cultural terms, we are failing to fulfill another key 60s value, our sense of community. We lost it one technological innovation, one demographic trend, one geographic shift at a time. Perhaps we didn't notice the gradual loss, but the price we've paid for convenience and mobility is high. We need a rebirth of community, and that presents a huge challenge in a society where our pain, fear, and disappointment fuel tribalism instead. What are some of the more specific reasons we haven't solved these problems? We have too small a circle of concern. For many, it does not extend much beyond self, family, or company. And too often when it does, with religion, for instance, it leads to identity conflict, us versus them. As a society, we take the short-term rather than the long-term view, made worse by corporations because it's good for sales and quarterly numbers. Old industries, and this is a huge drag on not only whether we take the right actions, but whether we take them in time, old industries use their accumulated power to delay and obstruct new ones. And with things like Citizens United, our politics have steadily become more and more instruments of that destructive strategy. We settle for the lazy belief that we've already tried and failed. and assume we can do no better. We accept that we have no power and therefore no responsibility. As a society, we've grown to disrespect and devalue government and nonprofits, leading to vicious cycles, feedback loops, and self-fulfilling prophecies that make their work harder and their success less likely. I started doing this show in 1996. Inequality was not something much talked about then, but I recall early conversations with economist Herman Daly on something he called sustainable economics, pointing out that both GDP and shareholder return did not tend to serve the greater good. Richard Grossman and others were questioning the role and definition of the corporation, which had originally been a way to limit liability when folks took on big projects, infrastructure, exploration, projects that had a common good in mind and then went out of existence when the project was complete. Winner Take All Politics by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson in 2011 made the case that following the advice of Friedman and Powell, wealth and big business had taken over politics and government, relentlessly rigging the game in their favor. 2012 saw the ill-defined and poorly organized Occupy movement, which nonetheless made the lasting contribution of giving us the notion of the 1% and the 99%. Today we face several crises that have either grown out of the distortion of our economy and our politics or are unsolvable because of them. Inequality, climate change, unhealthy relationship with nature, social division and tribalism, crippled government, and endangered democracy. Rebecca Henderson responds to this moment with a call basically to abandon the two dicta from the 70s that have become so ingrained in our society as to be like water to fish. We not only accept them as givens, we don't even realize how much they define our reality. What may be remarkable about her vision of radical change is who she expects to lead this charge. She is calling on the private sector to save us from itself. Let me just say a couple of more things about the pursuit of shareholder value. It can sound almost like a moral call that corporations be stewards of the wealth of American families and people's pensions, folks that have invested in stocks. I spoke to someone who managed money for clergy and religious institutions who told me he couldn't pull investments from fossil fuels because he owed maximized returns to his worthy clients. In practice, however, stock buybacks and rewarding top management for performance gauged by and paid in stock options are just two ways that the true nature of shareholder value is made obvious. Donald Trump, for instance, based most of his case for re-election on the performance of the stock market. But when COVID cases, unemployment, and the Dow are all at near historic highs, something is very, very wrong. Rebecca Henderson sees COVID as creating a turning point moment when the failures of our current way of doing things are painfully exposed, making positive and radical change possible. Rebecca Henderson, the MacArthur University professor at Harvard University, teaches the Reimagining Capitalism course at Harvard Business School. She's a research fellow with the National Bureau of Economic Research and was recently elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the British Academy. Henderson is an advisor to some of the world's leading companies and a board member of Amgen and IDEX Laboratories. Welcome, Rebecca Henderson, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Terence, thank you very much. I'm honored and delighted to be here.
Very good. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, November 11th. First, how are you? How are, for listeners, where are you and how are you coping with the resurgent pandemic and what we've all been going through for the last several months?
I'm incredibly privileged, Terence. My husband and I have a second home in New Hampshire. It's a cabin looking out over the mountains, and so I'm up there. The internet is sometimes tricky, but it is incredibly beautiful. And it's a great place to shelter in place. I feel so, so lucky.
And I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So I always ask them to share a bit about their path to the work they do today and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. Now, in the prologue to your book, you basically do this, and I found that it connected your passion and ideas and kind of sent me off into the book, you know, in a wonderful way. So your path.
Oh, thank you. In the prologue, I talk about the fact that I am a tree hugger. I spent many of my adolescent years lying on the great lower limb of a massive copper beech, looking up at the sky through its branches. My family life was a little troubled, and lying in a tree, reading and breathing that incredible air, you know, I think the whole air smells different when you're in a tree, and the light is different. And it just gave me a place to rest, a safe place, a beautiful place. And, you know, I became a huge outdoors person. I love hiking and kayaking and walking. I once walked the length of the Pyrenees with my brother, 6 weeks from sea to shining sea, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
But, you know, I always kept that part of myself in a box. So if you look at my CV, you know, it's got a lot of nice things on it. Engineering degree from MIT, PhD from Harvard, taught at MIT, yada, yada, yada. And professionally, I became something of an expert on why firms have so much difficulty changing. That comes from my background as a Brit. My first job out of college was working for a big consulting company, McKinsey, in London, and in the early 80s that meant closing plants in Northern England. So I became just fascinated by how could it be that companies that were, you know, 100 years old and had these incredible brand names and all these assets just couldn't seem to understand that the world was changing. So that became my professional life. I became a professor of technology and strategy at MIT. I actually was named to the Kodak chair, which was a complete coincidence, but deeply ironic, mm-hmm. because that's what I did. I worked with firms like Kodak to try and persuade them that the world was changing. I spent nearly 6 months of my life in Finland working with Nokia, who at the time was selling 1 million cell phones a week, trying to persuade them that Apple was a real and present threat. As you know, not with much success on that one. But that's what
yeah,
I did.
Yeah, it's Kodak and Nokia. Sounds like people didn't listen to you.
Well, I mentioned the dramatic public failures. But it was incredibly interesting. But I really had the two halves of my life in a box. You know, there was walking in the mountains with my husband and our son, and there was being a business school professor, and I just didn't connect them. Mm. And the connection happened one day 15 years ago when I saw Vice President Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And the movie fell on prepared ground. My brother is a freelance environmental journalist, and he'd been sending me material about the climate crisis. But I saw that movie and I came home and I emailed everyone on my contact list. I haven't done that either before or since. but I was like, whoa, you know, we have a very serious problem. And I realized that in a very real way, my job, you know, working at a business school, business in general, was helping to actively destroy the world I loved. Mm. My first thought was that I should just quit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I went to my activist friends and I said, so, you know, can I help organize? What can I do? Let's make a fuss. And they were the ones that persuaded me to stay at MIT as a business school professor. They said, look, business has a huge role to play in solving these problems. And they have a huge role to play in not making them worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so you should stay where you are. And I helped launch the first business and society course at business and sustainability course at MIT, and then 10 years ago moved to Harvard and started to teach the course that became the book. Initially the course was called Open Systems Strategy,
mm-hmm.
had 28 students, so the first thing we did the next year was like change the title, and it became Reimagining Capitalism, Business and the Big Problems, and got all the way up to 300 students. It was one of the fastest growing electives in Harvard Business School history. So that was super exciting. Lots of students interested, and they told me I had to write the book, so I did.
Okay, let me just say very quickly, the word you chose there, and you chose it, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, reimagining capitalism. I found when I was in a conversation with a lot of people about what was a better way to talk about what we need in terms of changing police and the, you know, police brutality, and the word the BLM movement had chosen was defund the police. We felt that was, you know, politically sketchy, and reimagining reimagining the police, reimagining law enforcement. This notion of reimagining seems to be on the rise. Why did you choose it, and what do you think about what I just said and what the meaning of that is?
So for me, reimagining is about hope and possibility. You know, defund the police seems to imply a particular solution, and I completely sympathize with the impulse, by the way. But it's not a rallying cry in some ways. And I thought the big issue was that capitalism was broken, but not fundamentally so. And it's interesting, since I published the book, I've spoken to so many people who say, why reimagine capitalism? Why not just throw it out the window? And I say, you know, and I really believe, we cannot solve the problems we face without it. There have been moments in human history when it has been an incredible source of prosperity and freedom and opportunity and possibility. And so I think we need to reimagine it, like embrace some of the fundamental ideas, but find a way to make them work for all of us. And I was trying to get students to take the class. And, you know, if you call it business and sustainability, you know, particularly then, sustainability had this kind of, I don't know, food that tastes nasty and costs more kind of overtone, you know? And it didn't, and it's not about being sustainable. I mean, who wants to be sustainable? We want to be growing and thriving and doing new things. And so I wanted, you know, something that gave that sense of hope. And I also wanted a title that was more systemic than just about business. You know, it's not just about business. We need a fundamental systemic shift, as your fantastic introduction sort of outlined just why we need that. I think business can help, but, you know, fixing business alone is not going to fix the problems we face. No way. So I wanted something bigger than just sustainable business.
It's funny. My next question was going to be any response to my introduction, not, you know, did you like it, but anything in, you know, I noticed Rachel Maddow, when she brings on a guest, often says, was I on point there? Was it, you know, anything, you know, anything you respond to, anything you want to correct, you probably know what I'm talking about. But yeah, any responses to that?
No, my first response was, well, what are we going to talk about? You've sort of summarized the diagnosis part of the book. And beautifully, may I say, I completely agree with your diagnosis. You know, I talk about capitalism being out of balance.
Yes.
That healthy societies rest on three foundations. Free market, free democratically accountable government, and something you didn't say explicitly, but I think it was implicit, which is a strong civil society. Representation for employees, a media that people trust, that tells the truth, impartial justice system. And we let ourselves believe that all business had to do was put their head down and maximize shareholder value.
Yeah.
And we told too many people that the right thing to do with government was drown it in the bathtub. And, you know, retrospect, you look back and you go, oh, my God. But, I mean, it made a lot of people very rich.
And as I think everything, you know, it all has to do with timing in a way. And when those folks came up with those dicta in 1970, we were so so successful, and it was so shared that, you know, it didn't look like they were calling for a fund, or it didn't register with most people they were calling for a fundamental change in orientation, that if you looked ahead, what are we now, 50 years, you would reap this whirlwind. I think, you know, it was, you know, it didn't look like it was that fork in the road that it was.
Oh, Terence, I completely agree. You know, and it's something sometimes tempting to paint some of the individuals involved as evil somehow. But, you know, when Milton Friedman said the social duty of the firm is to increase its profits, and I sometimes think he needed an asterisk. And the asterisk was, as long as there is a strong government that can price public goods and make sure externalities are controlled and that the society is genuinely inclusive and there are real public goods. I mean, it's one hell of an asterisk.
Yes.
But at the time, you know, he wrote that, you could sort of think that government was going to do its thing and it was going to be there and...
It was doing it, right?
It was doing its thing.
I mean,
it had done
yeah. major strides in civil rights, and now it seemed to be dealing with the environment, labor
yeah.
safety. Now, it's when you add the Powell memo to Friedman's shareholder value that things really get twisted.
Well, but even with the Powell memo, remember that at the time, a lot of people were advocating for much more state control over the economy. You know, it was a lot of talk about price controls. And,
oh, that's true.
Yeah, and you know, I'm an economist through and through. I think price controls are super problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And too much government power is just as dangerous as too much power to the private
mm-hmm.
sector. And so at the time... I don't think, I mean, I never knew Justice Powell, and who knows, but I'd be surprised if he had in his mind, well, let's completely flood the political system with money and set the entire agenda and delegitimize government to such an extent that trust collapses. I mean, I really hope he wasn't thinking that. I would guess that at least the group that started that was thinking about a rebalance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
And so then it becomes you had Grover Norquist to...
Well, and we know what happened next, and,
yeah.
it begins to build its own momentum.
That's
and
right.
It's
and
very
the,
successful.
The yeah. feedback loops, which you talk
yeah.
about, and Hacker and Pearson talk about. I recently interviewed Rob Johnson of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
For sure.
Branko Milanovic, one of the world's experts on inequality, and they both pointed to the feedback loops, that
yeah.
it isn't just that money in government is dangerous. And it isn't necessarily that money in government. It's that when money in government changes the rules to make it easier for money and harder for everyone else, that's what was created, and that's what we face the results of now.
To me, that's the central issue. You know, I, together with a group of academics, academic friends, we have a project called The Crisis in the Theory of the Firm. And here's the crisis. So the theory of the firm says, maximize shareholder value. Check. Well, one of the easiest ways to maximize shareholder value is to change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can get the government to make you a monopolist or pull back the regulation, what a lovely way to make money. But that's not what the underlying economic theory means. So the theory is completely intellectually incoherent because it doesn't have this asterisk.
Yes.
If the easiest way to make money is to change the rules, well, that's not appropriate. But in sort of neoclassical theory, the government somehow arrives and prices externalities and makes sure that everyone can compete and there are public goods. And there's no theory of where that government comes from or why it doesn't succumb to the power of money.
Mm.
Except, and here's the crazy, crazy thing about this, is Professor Friedman was really good friends with, I'm going to get his name wrong because they all start with S. Who's the guy who is at Chicago at the same time as Friedman and is pushing regulatory capture as the big problem? And, you know, we really need to be aware that any set of regulations is captured and this is a huge problem and how do we think about this? So it's a huge problem. And yet it doesn't get integrated into the theory of the firm or how to think about the relationship between politics and government at all.
Yeah.
So,
regulatory capture, for folks who that may be new to or just a little unfamiliar, I remember I first saw that when I was dealing with some environmental issues around landfills and was surprised to learn that the Browning Ferrises and the waste managements, the huge waste corporations, opposed regulation until it was inevitable. And when it was inevitable, they basically wrote it.
Yes.
And when they wrote it so that only the biggest firms could meet it. And that is, to me, just the perfect example of regulatory capture.
Beautiful example. And it works like that again and again. If you don't have a strong government with capable bureaucrats and a strong, you know, a strong press and NGOs, you know, watching, that's what happens. That this is why the rebalance of the system is so important. At the moment, I mean, the current administration has stopped enforcing all environmental regulations, which blows my mind. But those that are in place, many of them were written by the companies being regulated. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's, and as you point out, it's not just in the environment. The environment is really a clear, but you, I mean, wherever it is, whatever industry it is, the biggest players, when rules are inevitable, will make them for themselves. I think you mentioned that capitalism was broken. I certainly think democracy is broken. There's too many things that are broken, but it there's a format that I sort of approach shows with, whether I state it explicitly or not, and it's broke, let's fix it. First question, how do we know it's broken? What's the evidence? Second question, how did it get broken? What's the history? And third, how do we fix it? And I feel you're right that in my intro, I did sort of answer the first question, but I'll throw it to you if you want to put any nuance on it, which is, what's the evidence that, and as I think, I'll say, it isn't that capitalism is broken, but because capitalism is such a dominant part of our society, one could almost say, and so society is broken, and so government, you know, it's all the, but what's the evidence, the key evidence that capitalism is broken?
Apart from the fact that the planet's on fire.
And number one.
The vast majority of the productivity gains of the last 20 years have gone to the top, maybe
number
one, maybe
two.
10% of the society. Apart from the fact that more than half of the world's population, according to Edelman, say that capitalism is not working for them. And that more than half of Americans under 30 say they prefer socialism to capitalism. They probably mean they want decent healthcare, but it's not a good sign. Apart from the fact that our politics are so broken, that we have, I mean, I think you said it very well in your introduction, Terence, we have fallen into tribal warfare.
Yeah.
Here in the US, we're operating with different facts, completely different worldviews. We've lost any sense of ourselves as a coherent nation and a community. I mean, one of the things I loved about your diagnosis, I don't say it nearly as well, but I say we have become totally focused on me right now.
Yes.
And every major faith tradition, not to mention any parent of a two-year-old, knows that that's a deeply unskillful way to live. That when we lose connection with the broader community and with the future, we lose ourselves, we lose the game. I mean, this is not my field, but I think we have a major social and dare I say it, spiritual crisis on
yes.
our hands as well.
Yes, in other words, the positive impulse of caring for, defending, protecting, it breaks down depending on your, the expression I use was circle of concern. If that only goes as far as yourself, you're pathological. If it only goes as far as your family, you are still dangerous to the rest of society, even though what that's is sort of like what you said about the folks who made those dicta in 1970. Even though you're motivated by good impulses and for those that, you know, are within your circle of concern, you're a good person. But it's that we don't see long-term, big picture, and others as part of who we are here to serve and protect and honor and respect and all of those things.
So I couldn't agree more. And I want to put a twist on it because sometimes, you know, people hear this as, oh my God, they've gone into moralizing, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the problem here is, yes, there's a moral problem, but there's an enormous economic problem because societies don't work well if you don't make investments for the long term and if you don't take care of each other. And I think, I mean, for me, what's happening in the pandemic is a kind of example of this in miniature. When you see people who don't have health benefits, who can't take off sick days, who haven't enough savings that they can stop working when they get very sick, I mean, this is a threat to the whole society. The idea that I'm only well when you're well has become very, very visible. And the idea that, well, I have healthcare, but you, I don't care so much about you. I mean, what is that? We need a healthy society. And, you know, one of the things I find myself keeping having to say, because people sort of know it, but they don't want to think about it, which is there's an economic case for focusing on the long term and the good of our society. You know, if we don't address climate change, we are going to have trouble on spades. We already have trouble in spades. I mean, people say, look, in California, that was the hottest summer in the last 100 years. Well, very few people say that might be the coolest summer in the next 100.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a third of Bangladesh was underwater this summer. We're seeing the harvests fail as we get droughts and floods, and it's so interesting. It's the separation. Well, my moral self says I should care about the community in the long term, but your practical self also should be saying, you know, it would be really good to care about the community in the long term. And we've lost that sense that acting collectively makes us feel better, is the right thing to do, and oh my goodness, is going to get us out of these enormous problems.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that for me that you just pivoted to the COVID pandemic, which I think does create this moment in which all this, you know, it's funny. I trace this 50 years as pretty much so do you. And now we're at this moment. But let me tell people that this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Rebecca Henderson. She's the MacArthur University professor at Harvard University and author of Reimagining Capitalism. You can learn more at reimaginingcapitalism.org. So let's talk about this moment. And let me just frame it just a little bit. I think that one of the, despite the what we've learned about the inequities, both of how COVID attacks and how we respond, that there are obviously inequities that do have to do with wealth and so on, it still does, I think, create this sense of shared vulnerability and that maybe shared fate. And could that then lead us to maybe shared purpose? And I will even say that to me, the enormous response to the witnessing of George Floyd's killing, and as I say witnessing, even though we didn't all see it when it happened because of that 17-year-old girl's video, it felt as if we were. I think that happening in a culture on a moment of shared vulnerability sort of made that more powerful even. But I think, so I just wanted to put those two things together, but I think the shared vulnerability, as you say, creates a potential pivot moment, and I'd love you to speak more to that.
I do think it creates a pivot moment, and I hope the pivot is towards, particularly on the part of business, a much greater sense of shared responsibility for the health of the society and the institutions in which the firm's embedded. So, you know, I spent the last 15 years of my life going around saying purpose-driven firms are the way to go. They're more creative, they're more innovative, they're better able to see shifts that are happening in the world, they're much better places to work. You know, that's the direction we need to go in. And, you know, people look at me and go, oh, that's super interesting, Rebecca, and, you know, maybe, and I'm busy. And one of the things that the pandemic has done is really supercharge that conversation. Because I think many leaders have felt themselves emotionally responsible for their workforce in a way that some perhaps did not before. I mean, that sense that you are literally holding lives in your hand when you make policies as to, well, how are we going to structure the workplace and who's going to go back to work and how do we help those of our employees who are at home and maybe have small children? There's a whole kind of realm of broader experience that I think makes it much harder to say, employees are cogs in the wheel, we just manage them by the numbers, just go away. So it really opens up a space for implementing, you know, what is sometimes called high road employment practices, which sounds like a big deal, but really is just treat everyone with dignity and respect, make sure they have decent wages and reasonable benefits, give them the power they need to make the choices that they can make where they work so they can innovate and have some control and you know, help shape a purpose for the organization. So it's not just, I'm making money. It's like, why are we here? What are we doing? Where are we trying to get to? And all of those things, I think, become more real and more possible. You know, I recently heard a McKinsey partner in California, and we were on a panel together, and she said, you know, COVID has done two things to organizations. It's made them realize that rapid change is really possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, firms did things they thought would, you know, we're going to put everyone at home or we're going to move our entire system to digital. They thought it would take 6 months, a year, 2 years, and they got it done in 2 weeks or a month. And so that sense of possibility, and really, oh, we could manage in a different way. It could be different. So I think what the pandemic does is really open that up. And the second thing she said, and I've seen this too, but you know, to hear a McKinsey consultant say this, I was like, whoa, she said, so many CEOs and leaders have realized that in addition to doing, they need to be.
Mm.
That being is just as important. And I was so surprised, I wrote to her and said, could you say that again?
You know, because did I hear you right?
Did I hear you right? And, you know, she sent me back something she's written about it, and she really means it. She says, the fact that these leaders are home with their family and the children look at them and say, what is it you do at work, Daddy? The fact that they see employees really struggling in some ways, because let's be clear, this pandemic is a very tough time for many people, has really made CEOs think about, like, what am I about? Where am I going? One of my favorite CEOs, a guy called Bob Chapman, who runs a firm called Barry Weinmuller, has this phrase. He says, I want to treat all my employees, I want us all to treat each other as if we were all someone's precious child.
Mm-hmm.
What a radical idea.
Yeah.
But when you have people literally dying, and you know, I don't know about you, but I worry the heck out of my elderly mother, who is so vulnerable. You know, it really, really makes you worry. And we've had a couple of people die in our circle, and it, you know, I taught MBAs for 25 years before I started talking about love in the classroom. And I still don't talk about it very much because I'm an engineer and an economist. But ultimately, you know, what are we about? Where are we trying to get to? And I think the pandemic makes it clear that things can go really wrong, that we really need each other, and really calls into question what the role of business is. I mean, it does a number of other things which are super helpful we could talk about, but the key, I think, is we can change and people really matter.
Yeah. Let me just say
and
a couple of
super
things.
Important.
Yeah,
no.
A couple of things about COVID. One is, it was a talk I was listening to of yours, actually, I think, where it really hit home, that a CEO now looks and he sees that heroic people include this was something I think most people didn't see, not just doctors, but food deliverers and transit workers. It's so funny, I'm getting verklempt just saying this, but to realize that invisible people are essential is an amazing thing to see.
It's an amazing thing. Yeah.
And the other was, I spoke with Robert Frank, the economist from Cornell recently, and he was making the same point you did about the massive change. But he said, you know, we usually view social contagion, doing because others do, as a negative. Teens smoke because other teens smoke. People get fat because their friends get fat, right? And he said, what we've just seen in the last few months is the most rapid behavioral change on a global basis that has ever happened and that would never even, I mean, I suppose if we had said, what if the pandemic hit, could we do this? We might have said yes. But to actually see it happen and just happen so quickly is, I would think, to someone who has been stuck, you know, who has the authority to get unstuck but hasn't bothered because he didn't think it was possible, that's a wake-up call. The one question I want to make sure I ask before we get before we go is that when we talk whether we're talking about a CEO or someone just starting out in their career or someone, you know, just going to work every day, the feeling that I can't afford to do what's right in a system that doesn't. How do we?
Of course, of course, this is really important. There are many things that business cannot do because there's just no economic case for it. But, that doesn't mean there aren't things that can be done. My experience, and you know, I have a big group of colleagues at HBS, is not just about me. And what do? We write cases about firms that solve major social and environmental problems at billion-dollar scale and smaller. And we have hundreds of them. It's so often just an excuse. Well, the government can fix it. You need both, right? Yes, we need to fix the government. But right here, right now, there are tons of things firms can do. I already talked about the positive effects of treating people with more respect and giving them more power. We have, you know, huge amounts of research now that suggests not that that's the royal road to better performance. There's a lot of evidence that suggests it can lead you to better performance. Many of the world's most successful firms are run this way, but no guarantee. Lots of evidence you don't lose out managing this way.
Ah, okay, so what you're saying is you manage that way. It may not solve all the company's problems. It may not make you number one in your field, but it won't hurt you, which is why you've avoided it.
Exactly, exactly. Not only will it not hurt you, but everyone who works for you will feel so much better. You will have lots more ideas. Your productivity will go up. The commitment to the firm will go up. That may or may not make you richer, because it turns out that running a firm that way requires you to act like a good guy. So you do have to follow through on your promises, and there are businesses you shouldn't be in. And so sometimes you have to make choices that, you know, you could have done some bad stuff and made money. But you can absolutely survive in the competitive market. I mean, the data on that is really, really strong. So that's the first thing. And secondly, on this environmental stuff, you know, for so long we have thought of things like water and energy as essentially free that we haven't paid attention. You know, you just connect up to the water, you connect up to the power. For many firms, power is 3% of total costs. I mean, who cares? Not a big deal. Waste, someone just takes it away. We just haven't really thought about it. And it turns out that when you pay a little bit of attention, you can save a ton of money reducing your water usage, your energy usage, and cutting back your waste. I mean, an example I talk about all the time, but it's just so dramatic, is Walmart saved $1 billion a year. Even for Walmart, that's a lot of money.
Yes.
Straight to the bottom line by redesigning their trucking fleet to be more efficient. I mean, you know, boring, mundane, profitable.
Well, you know, even Walmart, even the changes, part of that the change, I think, that made that more efficient, part of it was just changing packaging.
Oh, they saved a ton of money changing the packaging.
Yeah.
You know, and they work with their suppliers. They say, you know, let us send a team to you. KKR, the big private equity firm, well-known tree huggers, not. They send a team into every firm they buy to cut water and waste usage because their experience has been you make 17, 18% rate of return on your money with these kinds of investments. Now, it doesn't solve all the problem. You can cut energy use in half and make, you know, and have that be profitable. That's what we did at Harvard. We took energy use on the campus down by about 40% and reduced our emissions that much and did it all making money. Now, this next half, it gets more expensive. We would love government policy. So it's not, people sometimes interpret what I'm saying as like business can solve all the problems. Of course not. But business can solve a ton of problems and make money in doing so. And as they do so, they act as a beacon for everyone else. They show people what is possible. And this is where it gets really tricky, I think, they begin to open up a pathway to collective action.
Yes, I know. That's the sort of point where you go, yeah, I sure hope so. That you have what would have to be called anecdotal, right? You have this.
I want you
to tell a couple of the stories just so people can hear that. But you have anecdotal evidence of this executive did it, this company did it, this company did it. But it's that where that S curve becomes inevitable when that tipping point when people go, it's worth it. And it becomes, as you say, collective. And it's interesting how, I interviewed another Harvard faculty member recently, Sam Myers.
Oh, sure. I love Sam. He's
about
great.
Planetary health.
Of course.
You know, obviously you can see I'm in this, you know, how all these things connect. But he very much says the same thing, that it demands collective action. And we've, you know, in this culture, you know, we elevate individuality over collective. We fear, you know, we disparage collective action as socialism, things like that. But it really is, it's the thing which gives it sort of the rocket boost from, you know, one person, one person, one person, one company, to actually, saving our society's bacon. One thing that just occurred to me as we were talking about COVID was, imagine if we had had a talented, skilled president when COVID hit. The argument for government being drowned in a bathtub would have been not just, oh, look at how bad it gets when you try to do that, but look at how much we needed it and that it worked. I think it would have been such a transfer. And, you know, Biden obviously starts out like coming in as a relief pitcher in the ninth inning with the bases loaded and behind by 10 runs. But I think if we begin to demonstrate that, I mean, nothing makes the case better than actually solving a problem.
Oh, but that was the other thing I was going to say about
COVID. Go ahead.
It makes the case for government. It's so clear it can't be solved by us individually, I think, that having a coherent public health strategy, a coherent vaccine strategy, setting a common expectation about the safety precautions we're going to take. And so I think the absence has helped make the case. But you're saying, well, if we start then to have positive government that knows what it's doing, that's going to make the case doubly. And I love that idea.
Yeah.
But let's come back to this idea, Terence, because for a solutions guy, you were getting a little bit down there when you said that, we're a society of individualists and there's no way we're going to do collective action and so on. So just a couple of things. First, we may be a society of individualists, but have you watched, like, a sports team or sports fans or heard people talk about their communities? I mean, yes, we're individualists, but we put on plays and we join enormous companies that, you know, no one ever calls them socialists, but let's see, they have 200,000 employees
exactly.
All working for a shared end, all trying to build trust amongst each other, all giving and taking in the service of the common good. I mean, that's pretty collective, if you ask me, at least in corporations that are working.
Right.
The other thing is, Americans are super pragmatic. And if collective action is needed to solve a problem, you can see people moving to collective action. And the examples I use in my book are the textile industry, firms like Nike and Levi and Gap, trying to clean up their supply chain. You know, they have massive problem with child labor and environmental damage and abuse of vulnerable workers in the supply chain. And they try cleaning it up individually and fail dismally. And decide, okay, let's get together. Let's try and address these problems together. And I talk about firms in the food industry like Pepsi or Unilever trying to stop deforestation because The commodities they're buying, beef and soy and palm oil, are leading to massive deforestation, and the NGOs are jumping up and down and screaming, and their brands are at risk, and they have to stop the deforestation. Only way to do it is to do it together. So I think, you know, it's not that we never work collectively. I mean, the Chicago Board of Trade was a collective self-regulatory body. The International Chamber of Commerce, which regulates global trade worldwide, is completely voluntary, completely self-regulatory, classic collective body. So we can do it. Now, as you suggest in the book, I'm not saying, well, this is a for sure thing and no problem, just sit back, it's going to happen. I'm like, it could happen. We might be smart enough to do this. Mm. And elements of it are starting to emerge. And I mean, I think we're in a desperate situation. So you know, if there's something that looks promising, let's go for it. And let's try and expand and support it.
Yeah. I'm going to throw one out that I don't even want you to respond to. But just that one of my concerns as I watch all this is that talking about collective action taken to the max, you have a country like China with an authoritarian system who can pivot quicker and mobilize faster. And what does it mean to the rest of the world and the way we organize society if they save us from climate change? If that system is the system that ends up dealing with the post-pandemic world in a more efficient way. And I don't think we have time to talk about that, but I really think our responsibility as stewards of democracy, as stewards of shared government and shared society is we've got to do better because the problems have to be solved. And I sure would like it to be solved by us. I don't mean that, you know, in that competitive way, but just that democracy could succeed.
Well, I agree with you. The idea that we must rely on China to solve global warming. And by the way, China's actions in the space are the best possible case for, there's an economic case for doing this.
Oh, yes.
I mean, they can see they have to address climate change. No, I'm completely with you. I'm surprised by the number of people who say to me, well, Rebecca, you're such a fan of democracy. What about China? You know, they seem to be doing better with the pandemic, better with climate change, better with bringing people out of poverty. You know, how do you answer? And I think it's a fantastic question, and we have to answer it.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think, as I said, pivots are easier. I remember I was interviewing Jared Diamond years ago and on his book Collapse. And he pointed out a successful response to an environmental problem was when China, there were floods that displaced 250 million people, which, you know, that's 2/3 of America displaced by floods. And they said, okay, why was that so harmful? Well, it was because of the erosion, because of deforestation. Well, let's stop deforestation.
Right.
And they did. Here, you would have a lumber lobby and a timber lobby and a this and a that. And, you know, you might eventually do it, but in the elapsed time, who knows what would happen. And so, but a democracy and a capitalism that isn't strangled by money, that isn't hamstrung by delays and denial, frees more creativity, frees more innovation, frees more enterprise. You know, I mean, we know that a healthy capitalism can beat a healthy authoritarianism.
Oh, but you use the phrase healthy authoritarianism. I mean, maybe China is healthy, but
yeah.
I read history as suggesting it's in a super dangerous situation.
Yes, true.
That any time power is that concentrated, you're at risk.
Yeah.
You're at risk of an elite running the society for their own benefit. And maybe the Chinese will be fortunate and avoid that. I think we can really hope so. But I think all the bets are authoritarianism as a solution? Not really. Have you looked at the history of?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'll tell you what. I am surprised. No, I haven't thought enough about this to say what I was just going to say. But I was going to say, I am surprised that they have been able to, you know, do what they've done economically and societally in that realm while you know, clamping down ever more. But that's a whole long and difficult
conversation.
It's a
whole nother conversation. Absolutely.
I'm going to give you one last question, and you got about 2 or 3 minutes, okay?
Okay.
You're standing in the future. 10, 15, 25 years have passed. You're looking back. Did we turn things around? And a couple of breakthrough moments of how it happened.
We did turn things around. And there was both a cultural breakthrough moment and a business breakthrough moment. The cultural one, of course, was when all the university students and all the children came out on the streets and said, you have to fix climate change and you have to fix inclusion. And they kept demonstrating until the major governments of the world started to implement strong climate policy and really investing in education and health and in inclusion in a way that completely changed the complexion of the world's elites. So that was exciting. But the other moment that passed with less fanfare, but happened before and was equally as important, was when 90% of the world's investors said, you know what? We insist that we find a path away from fossil fuels and that we have a healthy society to look forward to. And so that means really addressing inequality and really fixing the politics. And there was a big summit, kind of low key, in a country that we still not quite sure where it was, but somewhere in Asia, when 1,000 people looked each other in the eye and said, you know, it's got to be democracy and we've got to fix these, help fix these problems. So let's lobby to get money out of politics and to make sure that we're partners with democracy and not adversaries. And of course it was bumpy after that, but that was the turning point.
Wow. I have to tell you, Rebecca, I've asked that question, not every time at all, but every few interviews over the years, and no one has either answered it as well or as confidently as you did. So, you know, no, well, I really give you credit for that. It actually, you know, what it says to me is you actually have thought about this, but thought about it in a visionary way versus a analytical way. You've done the analytical, but that you've yeah. actually, you know, I don't think you could say that without some imagining or reimagining having taken place.
I've tried to write it down.
Ah.
I've tried to write down the history of the next 20 years in a way that gets us to a good place.
God.
I think it's really important to do. Humans are really good at imagining bad outcomes.
Yes.
I'm as good as anyone else. But actually, if you look back over the history of humanity, the last 300 years have been pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
They mm-hmm. really have.
Yeah.
And humans are very smart. And we have the technology and the resources to fix the problems we face. Fixing climate change is relatively easy. 2-3% of GDP, we know the technologies, we know the policies. Fixing inequality, harder, but absolutely not impossible. We know what happened in Europe in the 40s and 50s. We
Yep.
know what happened in the US. The Chinese brought 1 billion people out of poverty. We know how to do it. We just have to decide it's worth doing.
Very good. We got to bring this to a close. Thank you. By the way, I wouldn't mind either seeing if you've written that or someday getting on and just talking about that, about how we did it. About
Well, the reason you haven't seen it is it's tricky to do.
Yeah, of course it is.
It's tricky to do. But there's a fantastic new sci-fi novel out.
Oh.
Which is exactly this. It's a story of how we fix the world.
Oh.
It's Kim Stanley Robinson's latest novel.
Wonderful. Okay, again, the book is Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire. The website is reimaginingcapitalism.org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles, relevant, timely, fleshing out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, other major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts searchable at my site. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to GN Production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Rebecca Henderson. Keep up your good work.
Terrence, thank you. It's been a pleasure.